kind of his resume, he's an assistant professor at UT. He was an assistant professor of surgery at Uniformed Services University of Health Science. Dr. Anderson comes to us from the military. He was a staff pediatric orthopedic surgeon at Walter Reed National Hospital, associate resident program director at Walter Reed, staff orthopedic surgeon at Naval Hospital. His education was that he went through the Naval Academy. He did a residency in pediatric orthopedic and scoliosis fellowship at Texas Scottish Rite Hospital for Children in Dallas. He did an orthopedic residency at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. He's got a long resume. You know these docs, they put all this stuff in here. His athletic training coverage, and I do feel bad for him here a little bit. We did put him at Fulcher High School, which no nothing against Fulcher. Don't get me wrong. I know you guys. But before that, he was at Guam as a high school varsity athletic trainer or a physician covering Guam. And before that, he was at Coronado, California. Now, I don't know if any of you have been to San Diego, but Coronado is that island that sits outside of San Diego. I was just there a couple weeks ago. It's a wonderful place. So to come to Fulcher in you know, deep Texas is probably not quite the same as Guam and Coronado. But with that, I want to introduce Dr. Anderson as our next speaker.
First of all, let me say thank you very much for having me. It's an extreme privilege to get to speak to this group. As mentioned before, I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. What that means is that I take care of children, primarily developing bodies, with an interest towards sports medicine and a special interest around the young adult hip. And actually, I'd say young adult, the developing and young adult hip. I see patients with hip conditions from birth until hip replacement. I don't replace hips any longer. I do everything I can to save them. And so, a little bit of my background was given, but just so we get to figure out, who I am, since, they told me who all of you are. I've traveled a bit since I left Stillwater, Oklahoma back in 1996. Thanks to the wisdom of the United States Navy, I've been to several locations, but I did meet a Texas girl on my last stint here in Houston, and so therefore I'm back. I have an interest in hip conditions in particular, and you'll have to excuse me. I'm not going to attempt to cover all hip issues, hip injuries in young patients. This talk is colored by a little bit by my recent experience, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. But the two most the two things I want to talk about today are femoroacetabular impingement, which is a little bit of a popular topic at this time, and it's the most common thing or common ailment that I treat around the hip in my practice. And we still don't know exactly what the best treatment is. And the other one I want to talk about is slipped cap femoral epiphysis, which doesn't really belong in a sports medicine form like this, but I'll show you why I want to talk about it a little later. So what is femoroacetabular impingement? It's a fancy word, it's really long, but it just means any contact that's abnormal between the femur and the acetabulum, between the ball and the socket of the hip joint. Who presents with these with this condition? Well, typically they're young, and as you can see, less than 60. The issue is that it's not arthritis. This has nothing. The pain from this condition is not due to arthritis. It's actually due to pinching of the soft tissues. They're usually active patients, and they usually complain of hip pain wherever that may be for that individual person. We'll talk about that. On the slide up at the top right, you can see, just to orient you, the femoral heads are the lower left-hand corner. The acetabulum or hip socket is in the right side, and the labrum is outlined in blue. This is the view from an arthroscopic hip procedure. When patients complain of pain with hip impingement, they complain usually of two different places. Number one, in the front, in what we would consider the groin. And then the other, that's a technical term. And the other place is in the backside. That's another technical term, okay? So both of these places where people can complain, and oftentimes they'll make this sign, we've heard of the C sign perhaps, where they'll just say, it kind of hurts in here. And we call that the C sign. And so that's hip joint pathology. If they hurt way out here on the side, that's typically something to do with their hip abductors or something else. Their hip's not way out here. The anatomy that's involved includes the femur, which is the ball. I try to keep it simple, mainly because I'm from Oklahoma, but also because it's easier for patients to understand. The ball, and so there's a head and there's a neck, and the ball should be big and the neck should be thin, and that gives you plenty of room to move. Then there's a socket, and the hip socket's deep. Because the ball and socket joint is well constrained, doesn't dislocate very easily. And then there's the labrum, which is made out of, it's a gasket, all right? Just keeping it simple. It's just a gasket around that socket, and it's made of fibrocartilage. And its job is to seal the joint. Its job is to make it so that whenever you pull the hip out of the socket, you have to break a suction seal, and it adds to stability of the hip. And so you can see it there. And when you get impingement, this arrow is supposed to represent the sort of motion you might get, but you get that femur flexing up in high hip flexion activities and banging on the labrum before it actually impinges on the socket itself. So this is the most common risk factor for young hip pathology. In my practice, it is probably 5 to 1 over any other condition. This is the diagnosis I make when people present truly with hip pain. We're going to look at some of the anatomies or the pathologic anatomy and what that does specifically, but how do we get it? Well, we think it's developmental. There's something to activities. There's something to high hip flexion activities during youth or adolescence that leads people to get this. And it may be adaptive. There may be things that you can do because your hip has these shapes that allow it to impinge. So there's a downside, but there's also an upside. You can do certain things that other folks can't. And it is a common cause of labral tears. Oftentimes when I give talks on the hip or discussing the hip, you know, most people want to discuss, what are you going to do with the labrum? How do you repair that? Well, the labrum is simply the innocent victim in all this. And the culprit is, you know, bone on either side, and we'll talk about that. So the most common type of hip impingement, is CAM type. And what that means is asphericity of the ball, right? The ball should be round. And then it should go down to a narrow neck. Now, so if you look here at the image on the left, that's a fairly normal looking relationship with a big ball and a small neck. And this is what a CAM is. So this is, I had to get this off of Wikipedia because I never knew for a long time what a CAM was. But in case you're wondering, it's any protuberance from a rotating piece of machinery that translates rotational motion into linear motion. So every time that thing goes around, it doesn't touch, now it bumps. That's the analogy for the hip socket. Doesn't touch, now it bumps, and it bumps into the hip socket there. And so this is what the normal contour and the abnormal contour, and you can see the difference there. These are two hips, and these people both could be walking around without hip pain at all, but the one on the left is what we consider normal, and the one on the right is what we considered a CAM deformity. And you may hear me use that term, but a CAM deformity is what he has there. And so what that deformity does is without that extra space, the hip cannot move. It cannot move like it once would. And so there's a little bit of a cartoon that we got here. If you look at the hip on the left, see it coming up, and the one on the right, bang. And that's the impingement that causes lots of our issues. And so you can see the difference in the range of motion. And again, I know this is just a cartoon that I made up there, but this is how it works, I promise. The other type of femoroacetabular impingement is pincer impingement. And pincer works completely different. It's not the ball coming up and banging into the socket, it's not the ball coming up and sticking out into the socket, but it's actually banging into a socket that is too big. So the hip is too deep. The ball is too covered. And so it's a different mechanism. And in this type of hip impingement, the labrum really, really, really takes a hit. And so you can see here, if we look at these two balls, we're roughly the same size. But one of the socket on the right is just a little bit further out. And so it covers up a part of the, or more of the ball. And so for some people that may be fine, but for other folks that may cause an impingement, that may cause them to have hip pain. And so you can see here that labrum right there at the edge of the red area on the drawing there, that's the labrum, and that's what gets pinched when you have pincer impingement. By far the most common type of impingement is a combination of the two. It's almost always a combination of the two. And I think of the hip like a fingerprint in that everyone's got their own specific combinations of morphology. So, you know, some people are more sway backed. Again, my Oklahoma work's coming out. You know, some people have more lumbar lordosis and some people don't. Some people have more CAM morphology. Some people don't. Some people have more overhang. Their pelvis is tilted one way or the other. Their socket can be rotated one way or the other. And the femoral neck can be angled anywhere from 0 to 30 degrees. And so all these different factors interplay. And if you are unfortunate enough to do a lot of high hip flexion activities and you have the combination that causes impingement, then you can end up with some hip pain and end up tearing your labrum. So most commonly, it is a combined impingement. So what do they look like? What do these kids look like or young adults look like when they come see you? And the most common complaint is pain with sitting. And you can see if you're in a car, you got hip flexed up there, especially if you've got like a hot rod little car. And then they also say pain with activity, right? So pain with any of their sporting activities, primarily high hip flexion activities. On physical exam, the most common test that we use to assess whether or not the labrum itself is being pinched is called the impingement test, and it's demonstrated on the right. You flex the hip up to 90 degrees, the knee is flexed about 90 degrees, and you internally rotate. And what that does is that places a shear stress across the anterosuperior labrum. That's the most common place for to have a labral tear. So it places a shear stress across it. Now, if you guys go practice this or if you use this, you'll know that you can do it hard enough in anybody to hurt. So that's not the point. If you do this vigorous enough, this is going to be uncomfortable. But the question is can you, with very little force, recreate the pain that patient or that player is having? And so if that's the case, then you may consider that their labrum has been injured. And if their labrum has been injured, the most common reason for that is femoroacetabular impingement. Again, we talked about the C sign, and you might notice that they have decreased internal rotation. And that's usually not relative to their other side. It's usually relative to the rest of the, to what we consider normal in the population. So a lot of these athletes, especially football guys, the bigger the football guys are, they have a lot less internal rotation of their hips when you put them in this position. Again, it may be adaptive. And so when you look at radiographs, they have their complaint, that's part of their exam, and then we get radiographs. And a lot of times folks want to jump to the MRI, but I'm a big fan of X-ray. And X-ray gives me a story. It's like it gives me the whole story in one image. And these are all the things that we'll look at. Coming up yet? So we might measure the alpha angle. We'll measure the disc joint space. We'll measure the inclination. We'll measure the lateral center edge angle. And all these various things, information, trying to put together the picture about whether or not this athlete has pain that is coming from impingement within their hip. And then if you look even on, when we go into the operating room, we use fluoroscopy. So that's what this image is. And it's interesting because this is very important because that looks like a pretty normal hip, but this is in one position. This is just with their legs straight. If you put them in a functional position, and as I keep rotating up, you'll see they end up with a bit of a cam deformity there. And so by moving the leg around and putting it in functional positions using fluoroscopy, we can tell that certain areas of the femoral neck have a cam deformity that may or may not be causing the symptoms. It is very important for you to realize, though, that a lot of people, a lot of athletes, a lot of asymptomatic people have cam deformities. And I say the bone that lack of offset in the femoral neck. It's very common, up to 15 to 25%. And in athletes, it's even higher. So there's something, like I said, there's something about either the athletic activity that causes it, or there's something about that shape that allows you to be better at athletic activity. I don't know exactly why, and no one really does, but it's about twice as common in athletes. So just the key points to this point are that impingement anatomy is common. It's common to see stuff on x-rays, but what's most important is that if I see it on x-ray, it doesn't matter unless that person's having symptoms. But if that person's having symptoms, it's very important to get an x-ray. So those two go hand in hand. And then the other thing are that competitive athletes are at increased risk for having both impingement and the signs of impingement. When there is a tear when you have impingement, the pain, that has oftentimes been going on a long time. I liken that to, I got a 5-year-old who falls down all the time, and he goes out and plays and runs and falls and falls and falls, and then one day he comes in and says, I got a hole in the knee of my pants. And I said, well, that didn't all happen today. That wasn't just this one big fall. And so that's how the impingement works. They impinge and they impinge and they impinge, and it finally starts to become symptomatic near the end when the labrum starts to feel the effects of it. So it starts to tear. People love labral tears. We understand if something's torn, well, why don't you fix it, right? It's hard to explain to someone, well, you've got this sort of morphologic abnormality that may or may not be causing pressure within your hip. They don't get that, but they do understand this is torn, I need it fixed. And so people like to talk about labral tears. And repairing the labrum is perceived as kind of like that's all you need to do. And here's an example of a labral tear. It's the whitish area with the arrow on the right side there. Unfortunately, we can't just repair the labrum because it's like sending, if you don't change the conditions, you're sending that labrum back out into the same fight that it was in when it got torn in the first place. So we have to take care of the impingement bone as well as address the labrum. And MRI for labral tear is not that specific. It's just not that good a test. And so there's there's studies that show that after age 25, something on the order of 40 or 50% of the population has a labral tear on MRI. But 40 or 50% of the population doesn't have hip pain that's related to it. So there's pretty low clinical specificity. So if I have a story that looks good for hip impingement, an exam that's consistent with that, x-rays that show me some morphology that looks like it's hip impingement, and they get an MRI with a positive labral tear, my next step is to get an injection. And this is just an arthrogram. They put dye into the hip joint there to prove that they're there. And then what they do is they put numbing medicine inside. That numbing medicine, if the pain is coming from inside the hip joint, no matter what the cause is, that numbing medicine will make it good for a while. And so I have them keep a log, and usually if they have impingement, they're going to feel great for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, until the anesthetic wears off. And so in order for me to treat a patient for hip impingement, it's got to meet all these sort of criteria. And if it doesn't, then it's likely something else around the hip. And there's lots of other hip conditions, but we're just going to sort of focus on impingement today. The other thing is that sometimes there's cartilage damage due to the impingement. This happens most commonly with CAM. So you can see on the right, there's this leaf of cartilage. It's unstable, and that's from that CAM, that ball sneaking inside the hip joint. That's the part that's sticking inside the hip joint and rubbing that area away. And then you're left. And this is what arthritis is. I mean, this is the precursor to osteoarthritis. And so sometimes especially in football players, you'll do a 16 or 17-year-old football player, and this is what you'll find. Say, man, that's a tough deal. And they've been having hip pain for the last 2 years or 3 years or something like that, and just sort of playing through it. We don't have a good answer for that, and sort of what we do for it is unproven and definitely outside of the scope of this talk because I can't prove that it works. In general, treatment for hip impingement is non-operative. The reason why is that most times, especially in athletes, it's one episode of impingement. Either their leg got forced a certain way or they've increased their activities to a certain level, and their hip is fired up or it's inflamed. And so if we can just get it to calm down, they can go back to their baseline and get on with life. And so we do that with non-steroidals. Occasionally, cortisone injections, I rarely do it in anyone under 30. I just don't think it's worth it. But occasionally we'll do that, especially my older patients, my 30-plus will do it. And then physical therapy. And the main goal of physical therapy is also we got to figure out a way to get this hip calmed down. And then there are some modifiable risk factors as far as core strength, hip abductor strength, gluteus maximus strength, that you can use to change the way the patient carries their hip just enough. We just need a few millimeters of clearance here so that they're no longer impinging with their activities. And so if you can find some strength deficits, especially glute max, to help out with that, then possibly you can remove their impingement through physical therapy. If that doesn't work, then there is surgical treatment. And again, the surgical goals are to alleviate the impingement first and then repair the cartilage. And then evidence suggests that the longer we wait for surgery, the outcomes sort of go down. And that applies mostly to an adult population. We're not talking about waiting 6 months or, 6 weeks to the end of the season or something like that. We're talking about waiting 5-10 years and sort of limping along through life. But the evidence does show that at this stage. And so surgically, let me back up, sorry. So this is the outline. So this is a case that we did, or that I did, excuse me. This is an outline of the CAM deformity that we found. And then that's what I thought the shape of the hip should look like in that location. And so you go in with a burr and you're able to remove it and you're able to change the shape to alleviate the impingement. You also have to repair the labrum, but this, in my mind, is the most important part of the surgery by far. So you can see the area that we've taken off. Okay. Postoperatively, what do we do for these patients? You may see them in your training rooms. You may see them in your clinics. There's an early phase, depending on the surgeon preference, anywhere up to 4 weeks on crutches. Soft tissue modalities are good and early range of motion. Big thing for these kids is they can go to school. Not a big deal. They can go to school as soon as their pain is controlled. So sometimes I'll do these on a Thursday and the kids are back in school on Monday, especially if we only have to do bony work on one side of the joint or the other. Typically, return to sport is 5 to 6 months. That's what I tell them. I've had people go back as early as 3 months. In the military, I had guys who had to be deployed, who came for their 6-week checkup and said, thanks, doc, I'm going to Afghanistan, appreciate it. but typically 5 to 6 months before they're back, not worrying too much about their hip. So that's it on hip impingement. I have like 3 minutes or two, and I would like to discuss the other condition briefly because you may not have seen it before, but there's a distinct possibility that it's seen you, and it's called slipped capital femoral epiphysis. And as you can see the image on the right, you know, something ain't right, right? So this is a fracture through the growth plate of the proximal femur. Males get it more than females. The age for males is slightly older just because of the skeletal maturity, but, you know, 13 and a half for males, 12 for females. And this is a condition of two patient groups primarily. Number one, anyone with an endocrine disorder. So, and this is not, doesn't necessarily apply to athletics necessarily, but hypothyroidism, diabetes, any of these endocrine disorders, those patients are at high risk for this. And then obese patients are at high risk for this. So, so when these guys are on your team, okay, or they're in your clinic, and they complain of hip or knee pain. If it's hip or knee pain, and you can't put your finger on the knee pain, and I mean put your finger on it and cause it, then you need to seriously consider looking at their hip, okay? Because this is very, very commonly misdiagnosed for a long period of time, and early diagnosis prevents the morbidity, like significant morbidity. And I'm working on a kid right now. This is why I added this to the talk, because it still happens, and I'm kind of feeling bad right now because he showed up kind of late. So this is the anatomy. You can see, I don't know if this thing will work. The nerve right here runs right across the hip joint down to the inside of the knee. And so if you get inflammation or pain generated here, it can be referred to the knee. And this seems to be stronger in pediatric patients. And the injury that this most mimics is a medial meniscus tear. You're not quite sure what's going on. They don't have laxity on the inside of the knee, but they keep complaining of pain right here. And so on this image, you know, they've drawn where this patient complained of, where this nerve distribution is. And I've actually found that it kind of goes down even further than that. And so if it's mild, so you can see this is mild. This is just a little bit of a slip, just a little bit of a slip through this growth plate. And it happened during a sport. It's usually track or a fall during football or basketball, but a little slip. And so when you get that one, I can put a screw in it. 6 weeks with crutches, and they usually do okay. But sometimes you get this. See that? This belongs way over here. And this kid had been worked up for his diagnosis. Working diagnosis was an MCL tear. And he had been in physical therapy, and the therapist kept saying that the therapy's just making his hip worse, or excuse me, making his knee pain worse, you know. And so this is an absolute disaster. And this kid is currently under my care, and we're doing everything we can to avoid a hip replacement. But he's an athlete. He fell playing football, and so you may see this. And so if you don't, you know. And so this is what we did, and we hope this worked. We kind of put the ice cream back on top of the scoop, right? But this is a big deal surgery. This is, you know, blood loss and infection risk and all that versus, you know, the one where we just put the screw in, that's pretty straightforward. And had we gotten to this kid 8 months ago, we probably could have just thrown a screw in it. And unfortunately, sometimes, this is not one of mine, but I borrowed this slide, you know, we don't get there in time. And this is end-stage arthritis. And so this is a teenager that's about to get a hip replacement. So that's all I have on this happy note. But it's very, I'm sorry if I, but I'm serious because a lot of times it's not talked about because it's not a sports injury, but it happens during sports. And you're going to see it and they're going to see it. So if one person comes out of here and says, hey, we're, you know, that big heavy kid on my team who keeps complaining of knee pain every time we make him do something, he's not just fat. Maybe, you know, maybe it's something else, right? And so you should encourage them to get their hips looked at, especially if it's knee pain. That's it. Thank you.
Dr. Anderson, thank you. I think we've got a couple minutes. This is an area that I think is, to me, I mean, I've been in this business forever. And, you know, we never heard of these kind of hip injuries, you know, 15, 20 years ago. I had the fortunate advantage of working with a physician in Nashville when I was there that was kind of working as we kind of developed over the last 20 years. He was really starting to develop a lot of the arthroscopy stuff that took place. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the interesting part of this thing that I learned and, you know, listening to Dr. Anderson this morning, it reinforces it, is I think we've all probably seen this and we don't know we saw it. And I think that's the interesting part of these hip things is that we're probably seeing them and we don't realize what they are. We think they strained a groin or they, you know, they just landed wrong or they did something and we kind of poo-poo it a little bit and think, oh, he's going to get better. You know, and something that I kind of learned was, I think the old secret to a lot of these things in athletic training, if you see these kids every day and you kind of work with them every day, if they're not getting better with what you're doing, then it's probably worth investigating a little bit more to see what's going on. And this is probably a great example of that in the stuff that, from that sense.